Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books and Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I've only said that 1,000 times, so of course. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I have the pleasure of speaking once again with Dr. Brian Hatcher, who is Professor of Religion at Tufts University. We'll be speaking about a brand new OUP publication that's part of the AAR Religion and Translation series, and it's called Against High Caste Polygamy, an Annotated Translation. Brian, welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, Raj. It's great to be back. It's really great to see you. I guess listeners can't see you, but I can, and that's a real treat.
Those listening, right? Yeah, sometimes folks like a peek behind the curtain sometimes. So for those listening, I actually do all podcasts on Zoom. So there is a video interface. We can see each other. When I started the podcast, I started my involvement with the podcast. The podcast predates me, of course. I was doing interviews on Zoom. This was maybe 2018, actually. I've been teaching online on Zoom since 2017, and no one knew what Zoom was. And now the world has changed, hasn't it?
We know far more about Zoom than we care to, probably. I found myself wondering, oh, I wonder what shirt I should wear for my interview with Raj today. I thought, well, it doesn't really matter.
You don't even have to wear a shirt. You don't even have to wear a shirt, bro.
Well, listeners, I have a shirt on.
Yes, he does. And it's a dapper business casual dark colored shirt. Very apropos. The last time I spoke to you was around the beginning of the pandemic, wasn't it? It was 2020.
It was March or April 2020.
You know, what's really funny,
particularly, you know, inauspicious timing for a book to come out, right? AES had just canceled, I think, and everything was shutting down. And I thought, well, this book is not being seen by anybody. So I was really grateful to you to pick it up for the podcast.
It was my pleasure. And as I see it, my duty actually as well. But what's interesting is that I think I did maybe 20 podcasts altogether the year before that. And I just inherited in 2018, I did a handful, maybe about 20-ish in 2019. When the pandemic hit, I thought to myself, hey, this is an opportunity to contribute to the war effort. Because I thought, look, people are at home needing content. People might be teaching online and the digital content might come in handy. But also I thought people are cooped up just to even have a conversation with someone on Zoom. And what's really interesting, Brian, is the world is so changed that initially I thought I'd amp up the pace. So I was doing 4 to 6 a month-ish, exactly starting April 2020. And I sort of thought, let me continue while the pandemic is still an issue. And, you know, it was an issue on and off and on and off. And, you know the story, we've all lived through it. Those of us who are still here. And the pace never changed. And so now it's just part of the pandemic has sort of, yeah, you know, co-author this lifestyle of podcasting for me. It's really interesting.
Well, we're all grateful. it's an immense service. As you say, it's kind of your duty, but it's not a duty. It's something you choose to do, and we're appreciative of it. I know I am.
Yes, thank you. I've gotten some lovely comments over the years, for sure. I feel the community appreciates it, and the listeners as well. And, you know, it gives me an opportunity to, in an alternate universe, I think I would have done ethnographic research. But it gives me an opportunity to do to interview people about their research, which is kind of fun.
So kind of an ethnography.
Yeah, I suppose it is. So your book is called Against High Caste Polygamy. And so first and foremost is going to be the question of how did you get into this? How did this project come about for you?
Well, I mean, it's a perfect question to begin with, just thinking about our prior interview back in 2020, because this was really my pandemic project. I had, and you mentioned ethnography, I had a project going on that was more field-based in West Bengal, studying the expansion of a Dasnami, a network of muttas or monasteries around Southwest Bengal. And I've been going annually to visit sites and try to, you know, find evidence on the ground if I could. So that was really going full speed, and I was having a lot of fun with it. And then, of course, the pandemic hit. And as you say, we were all locked down at home. And there were just all those evenings thinking about what can I do with my time. And thankfully, there on my shelf was the Ratchanabali of the Dashagar's collected works. And I thought the other great reform work that he had written and for which he was well known was his assault on the practice of Kulin polygamy. So I thought, I had done widow marriage and translated that back in 2011, 2012. And I thought, this is the bookend to that. So I'm going to have a lot of time on my hands. Maybe this is the perfect pandemic project. So I just kind of began doing it in a loose leaf binder and translating with a pencil and sitting up at night listening to music doing that. And then I realized over time, obviously, this was going to become possibly the makings of a book. So very much something to keep me occupied and kind of give me solace in all those weeks and months of lockdown. But also, it felt like one remaining task that I had addressed with my work on the Dashagar over the years. So I was really pleased to kind of have it emerge in that way and become something that in time could become the book that it has. So.
I love the fact that, I mean, there are many ways in which books come into being. Often, you know, the whole dissertation to book project that is so seminal to academic enterprise, tenure portfolios, et cetera, but it's refreshing to have an organic process where you're just doodling away with ideas and you're learning. You know, that I've got time, I've got interest, I'm learning. And hey, all this learning, I'll put together and present it to teach others what I've learned. And that's, I see publication as education. That's probably why I resonate with the podcast so much. This is about teaching the public what we've learned. And tell us about, let's see, what are you looking at for your data for this book?
So the principal datum was the work that Bindashagar wrote under the title in Bengali, Abahu Bibaho, which is like plural marriage, if you will. And he actually wrote two books, part one and part two. Part two is longer than part one, and it's I decided not to translate it, at least not for publication, because it's very dense with ad hominem attacks on other pundits who didn't agree with him about the Sanskrit basis of this law or this custom, if you will. And so it felt very, a very microcosmic world that a lot of readers wouldn't really find all that attractive to enter into or have their bearings to get around in it. So book one, which he published in 1871, struck me as having much more continued salience, resonance on a lot of levels with thinking about colonial intellectual history, development of Hindu law in this period, thinking about reform generally in the late 19th century. So there were a lot of reasons why it struck me as a work that bore translation. And so I had the collected works in which Bahu Bibaho Part 1 was included, and then I had found thank God for archive.org and all these online sources that we have now, I could get access to PDF copies of scanned versions of the book. So I was able to kind of make sure that the printed version of the collected works was, you know, congruent with what the original publication looked like. And then thankfully, you know, we're all grateful for the Zoom and technology. We can be in touch with colleagues in Kolkata and in London and places and make sure that we could double check references where we needed to and all that. So for a project, when you're trapped at home, you at least could reach out through social media and internet to make sure you were right, keeping on track. So the data was really just the published text of Bahu Vibahu, some Bengali dictionaries, and the project of translating.
Set the stage for us. Set the stage about this high caste polygamy. What was going on? Or not going on?
Yeah. Well, what was really going on robustly was basically a business or an economy built around the exchange of women in a sort of customary practices. Vidyashagar addresses Brahmins and Kayasthas, but it's also common amongst Vaidya communities and Bengal and other groups have practices of kulin exchange, but his focus in the book is on Brahmins and Kayasthas, the two most prominent sort of groups. So broadly, just to back up, this kulin polygamy that he's talking about, it's restricted to Bengal. It's a very, very much a Bengali Hindu practice that comes out of what Ron Indian would call the middle period or sort of medieval Bengal, develops over time, and Vidyashagar gives us an attempt to sketch the history of how it developed. So that's one issue of why did it develop the way it did? But then in his day, what he's looking at is the rampant, what he thinks are the rampant abuses of this custom, and the principal target and suffering of this is, of course, the women trapped inside this economy, who are basically, you know, used in exchange relations whereby groups are attempting to improve or maintain their status through transactions in which the women are exchanged and wealth is at the center of this, right? And so what you have is a system in his day where a high caste man with kulin status, so kulin speaks to a high grade status within Brahmin or Kayasth communities and the targets of gifting of women ideally. And so some of these men were in a position to accept multiple brides, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 50. There's reports of upward of 100 wives. And of course, these men would inevitably die, and their wives were often quite young. And so they were in the lives of enforced widowhood. And even when alive, if you can imagine a man with 20, 25 wives, he often didn't see the majority of them at all, is maybe once a year. So it's a very rampant system in which women were trapped and suffered tremendously. They often lived in their maternal uncle's home, and they were, of course, a burden on the family and seen as just a kind of drag on the economy of that family. And so they're just a really miserable existence. And when their husband died, they had to live in life was widowhood with all those restrictions. Many of them would actually take the drastic step of committing suicide to escape the strictures and rigors of what they were faced with. Others were lured into lives, you know, sex trafficking, basically. In Vidyashagar's day, you know, the words he would use would be prostitution and adultery. These were, I think, words he used to scare his high caste audiences into the horrors of kind of social enemy and malaise and the corruption of women to get them to realize that the costs of this practice were heinous on whatever level you looked at them. But he was also really troubled by the sheer greed and the ways in which women were just completely lost from view in these processes of exchange.
Walk us through some of the objections he raises. What are the arguments he makes against it?
Well, it's interesting. So the book is framed actually around 7 objections that he attempts to address. So it's very much like you're a Sanskrit scholar, you know, this sort of Purvapaksha kind of idea. And so he's got all these objections that he's made note of. And so the book proceeds through his attempt to answer each of these objections in turn. by way of saying anything you throw at me by way of saying a law against Kulin polygamy is invalid, I have an answer for. And they begin with, as readers of the Hindu widow marriage translation will recognize, with the probably the obvious place for a Sanskrit pundit to start is with the question of whether it's congruent with what the Shastras teach, right? Is this something that the Hindu scriptures even allow for? And of course, the proponents of it find passages in Manu and elsewhere to say it's clear that polygamy was allowed in the classical period, and therefore we have scriptural warrant. But he mounts his own counterattack on that, and he musters a lot of classical and medieval and sources, Nibandhas and Paramashastras and all of that sort of thing. So he does the kind of first two objections are really focused on the kind of scriptural warrant and some of the development around the practice. That's probably more interest to Sanskritists and scholars of colonial Hindu law. But then the remaining five objections, he moves into everything from what this might do to the established practices among certain groups of Kayasthas who basically have made a business, as he puts it, out of doing this, and they don't want to see that business and those opportunities disrupted, right on through objections from some of what he calls the newly educated community, who think we don't have to legislate against this at all because education is going to take care of the problem. We're becoming rapidly enlightened here in Bengal, and so with time, people are just going to move away from this kind of practice. And so he's got answers to all these objections. And in that case, he simply mounts a bunch of evidence, if you will, to show them that, look, we say modern education is making a difference, but look at these figures. And he goes out in the field, and we're talking about field work. He actually gathers numbers, and more than that, names and ages and numbers of marriages for men in the district of Hooligan to the sort of west of Kolkata. And he lists them ad extenso. And it's really quite striking. I mean, it's a really interesting tactic to embed in the text these lists of hundreds of names. And he gives the actual first name, last name, age of the person, where they live, how many marriages they've had. And of course, it couldn't do that today, right? Probably it's going to violate our policies around how to conduct research. But he's trying to make a point. And it's very, very powerful. And I talked to more than one person. They read the work. That's one of the things that sticks in their minds are just these lists. It brings home the evident sort of extent of this problem, that it's not something that is vanishing. It's actually carrying on robustly.
The work is quite, I want to say, litigious in how he sets it out. And could you tell us a bit about Vijayasagar's background? Tell us a bit about the man behind the work.
Well, you know, he's a Sanskrit pundit, so of a kind of modern ilk, though. I mean, comes from a pundit family in the rural Bengal, but as some listeners will know, he of course benefits from the creation of a new college in Kolkata by the British, known as the Calcutta Government Sanskrit College, and so he's educated there. It's a traditional curriculum, but it's delivered in this new institution, so it's a kind of a hybrid form of Sanskrit education. But he goes on and earns the title of Vidyasagar, or Ocean of Learning, and makes his name early on as an educator and publisher of new works in Bangla that would kind of make the Bengali language easily accessible, and also make the treasure of the Sanskrit literature available in Bangla to Bengali readers. So that's a big part of what he does. But early on, he's also engaging with what he sees as the issue of social change around him. He's in many ways the heir to Ram Mohan Roy. If listeners know about Ram Mohan Roy as the sort of the man who conducted his campaign against sati, or the practice of a widow immolation, Vidyasagar kind of takes up the next issue as well. If we get rid of widow immolation, then we have to take care of the widows themselves, who will now be allowed to live their lives and not have to practice concremation or whatever. So he advances this argument in 1855, asking the British government to legalize second marriages for widows. And that's successful. And so that's probably where he gets his initial renown and gains a lot of his expertise around how to conduct the kind of litigious and polemical work that you're referring to. He's quite skillful at mounting this kind of argument, and he has got a dual audience of convincing the Bengali public, but also convincing the British colonial authorities that this is a reform they can embrace. And in, as I try to show in the book, in the 1850s, the British were amenable to that kind of argument, and they were willing to intervene in kind of religious and social affairs to enact this legislation. By the 1870s, we've had the so-called rebellion or the mutiny, and they're much more anxious. They're far less interested in intervening anymore. Some of them feeling that it actually had been aggressive reform, like the widow marriage campaign, that might have lit the spark under the rebellion itself. So this the times have just changed incredibly by 1871. And I think this is one point where we see Vidyasagar's not quite keeping up with the changes, not quite seeing that this sort of attempt is no longer going to succeed with the British. And at the same time, his Bengali contemporaries are also increasingly reluctant to keep going to the British to ask them to solve their affairs. They begin to say, let's take care of our own affairs. Let's, if we have problems, we'll address them ourselves. We don't need to ask the British to do this. So he's kind of failed to see that the times have changed so much. So the widow marriage campaign succeeds. This one is a failure. It doesn't issue into any legislation. But as I put in the book, I think it's interesting that the widow marriage was a success that basically turned out to be a failure, because that reform didn't really lead to any widespread change in marriage practices in Bengal. And that actually may have inadvertently led to an increase of prohibition on widow marriage amongst certain caste groups. So it had the sort of unintended consequence of promoting the idea that, oh, if you want high status, you should not allow your widows to marry. So unfortunately, it was kind of a failure, whereas this book was a failure, you could say, but in some sense it portended the success that by the 20th century, Kulin polygamy really had pretty much begun to fade away as a viable system any longer, though it would take up until the Indian Code Bill before polygamy would be officially outlawed. So that's a long story.
No, that's great.
And anyway, and I've gone on at greater length, but I just...
No, that's great, because
each to another.
Well, that's the way it goes. And also you essentially unwittingly preempted one of the questions on my list, which was, how successful was this campaign, or what was the effect of this work? And so that's great. You touched on that. So another question I had in mind that you touched on in passing is the dual audience. So do you have, let me rephrase that. Who do you feel was the primary intended audience of this work?
Yeah, well, I think it was, I'm going to stick to the idea of it being two audiences, really. Vidyasagar had served on a committee that had been formed by the Lieutenant Governor, Beaton, to pursue the topic, because Beaton had kind of made noises that he would address this problem. So there was some sense in the air that maybe the British would deal with this through legislative enactment. And there had been proposals prior to this work of Vidyasagar's to try to get this done. So he'd served on a committee, and the committee was formed of a number of Bengalis and intellectuals, judges, jurists, university people, and they couldn't come to an agreement and finally opted not to support the idea of any intervention. And this really disappointed Vidyasagar. So he knows he's got to convince the British the committee avenue is not going to work. So I think he's writing to them now, his own moral sort of from his own pulpit, if you will. But he's got the British Bengali reading public as well. And they've become more and more sophisticated in their readership. You know, there's more and more journals by this point. There are more and more competing voices in play. So people like Bunkim Chandra Chatterjee, for instance, the great literature and social critic himself, who was no great fan of Bhinnashravakas. And so there, you've got to kind of win over these other highly educated, highly competent Bengali social critics. And so he's fighting this dual front. And that it kind of gives the work an interesting feel, I think.
On the topic of audiences, who is this translation for? Yeah. Who might most benefit from this translation?
Well, you know, I always worry with these works that there's a limited audience in this, insofar as how many people are interested in marriage practices in colonial Bengal. But if you broaden it out to think about colonialism more generally, or colonial law, or the processes of social reform in places like colonial India, then I think there's a readership there for South Asian historians, scholars of intellectual history, colonialism, post-colonial studies, etc. I gave it the title Against High Caste Polygamy. It's a more robust title than he used. His was just plural marriage, doesn't tell us much. So I deliberately chose a title that would reach out to an audience that would recognize, in particular, the words like caste, and chose high caste because this is, you know, these are privileged caste communities that we're talking about. But I thought that might at least communicate we're in the realm of Hindu social custom. And so I think scholars and teachers of Hinduism, students of Hinduism, thinking in particular about gender and the role of women and the status of women and the transformations and lingering issues under that score, all I think are possible audiences. I was really pleased that I could use a photograph I took myself of a Hindu widow entering a shrine in West Bengal, because it had been easy to pick like a sepia tinted image of a woman, you know, from a colonial lithograph or something like that. But that would have, to my mind, sort of suggested this is the work entirely of the past in some ways. And I think the legacy of all these issues around the treatment and status of women in South Asian culture linger down to the present, not least around ancillary issues like inheritance, property rights, etc. And all these issues have not been worked out. Here we are, 200 years after Bhinnashravakas' birthdate, where India is still struggling with how to achieve real gender justice. So I'm happy to have a cover that registers a kind of contemporaneity to it, even if the issue was obviously late 19th century. So I mean, there's a broader audience, to answer your question, but
just touch first of all, absolutely, there's a broader audience, which is without question there is. There always is. It's a question of reaching it. As a question to my mind of the work that we do as scholars, the hair splitting work that we do is important, but our motivations, consciously or unconsciously, our interests, they tie into much larger, they overlap with the interests of much larger swaths of people. You know, what the heck do I study? I study the Devi Mahatmya. I study an ancient Indian narrative about the first stories of the great goddess in India. Great. Well, Devi Mahatmya, well, I don't know what that is. Itihasa Purana, who the heck knows what that is? I study the very first stories of the great goddess in India, which, to my knowledge, is really the world's only living, vibrant following of a great goddess figure that has survived from antiquity and et cetera, et cetera. So I study how to read stories. You know, all of a sudden, okay, anyone interested in reader response theory or Umberto Eco or blah, 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 blah. I think there always is a broader... there are broader connotations, and that's what I love to bring out on these podcasts. Like, that's why I keep it so high level, because if folks are interested, they'll grab the book. They know already if they need this for their research or their teaching or their personal edification. But thinking about this, listen, the issue of the treatment of women is not just something that has been needs to be worked out in South Asia, but hello, look at the moment in history we're living through, and certainly there may be others, people interested in this issue coming at it from other disciplines. who might be interested. So without question, there's a broader audience for the book. Secondly, that photo, it's quite captivating. I must have missed the photo credit, but I didn't realize it was yours. Actually, it holds a lure, right? Like, you want to follow her. You want to see where she's going in that threshold.
Yeah.
It captures the idea of liminality really well, of being in a threshold between spaces.
That's quite, yeah, absolutely. I was really pleased. I had actually a little tussle with the press because they have a very firm policy about anonymity and not revealing identity of photographic subjects. And I fully support that. And I made the case that, look, I don't think this woman is identifiable. She's fully veiled. She's turned away from the camera. She's entering the space. But they wanted to proceed cautiously. Their first instinct was, no, we can't use this image. But I was so grateful. I had contacts in the village, and I had a friend in Kolkata who could WhatsApp this person in the village and speak to them and share the photo around. He couldn't even in the village identify who the woman was. So he said, I think you can certainly use this image. So I took that back to the press, and the press was satisfied that, okay, don't name the village, and so it seems highly unlikely that anyone could be identified. But to me, it was, yeah, I just really, really wanted to stick with it because the idea of a kind of full frontal, passive woman from the 19th century who's seated in a parlor and in a kind of photographic studio, it seemed to objectify her and not give her the kind of agency that we see with this woman. And I think, you know, Binda Chagres, I make the point that his goal in these works is really to get Bengalis to recognize the women around them, the practices, their social evils that fall upon them because of the practices of Bengal Brahmins and upper caste groups. And so he really wants Bengalis to see them. So I wanted to have an image that kind of also helped us see them in a real way. So I'm glad you appreciated it.
Personally, would you say a quick word about your process, your translation process? What's that like for you?
Yeah, and thanks for asking that, because there's one element of the translation I want to highlight, and I'm eager and will be waiting to hear what any reviewers might say. But usually I'll sit down, as I said, with a pencil and paper. I prefer to kind of work that way, scribbling and crossing out. I feel like when I start on the keyboard, I begin editing too robustly and I lose track of the rhythm of the translation, just attending to the language. Usually I'll do that as a kind of a rough translation, very literal. I mean, I'll be as close to the literal translation as I can, rough in the sense that it won't sound very good, right? It's because I'm sticking so close to the verbatim meaning. And then once I've gotten that out, I'll take the handwritten translation and then I'll begin transcribing that onto a Word document. And then that's the time I try to listen to the words and see if they sound right in English and think about the idioms and some of the varying tonality that he may have as he's engaging, whether it's a British administrative kind of audience in this moment, or whether he's talking to his fellow Bengalis. He's got a measure of sarcasm and irony that comes through in certain places. So you kind of want to see if you're capturing that. So in that transcription process, I have a chance to listen a little more, and probably I'll risk taking the text a little more away from the literal in order to capture some of the spirit of it, hopefully, I hope. And then, you know, just after that, it's a matter of further revision to see that the thing kind of feels as if it reads in English as well as it does in Bengali. One of the things I did, and if you allow me to just say this because it's the thing I'm kind of curious how people will respond. I mentioned earlier those lists. So in certain points, Binda Chagres introduces quite a bit of detailed evidence, which is one of the elements I'm also eager for readers to discover, because I make the case that he's doing some things in here that make him something like an early social scientist. He's gathering data. He's doing kind of statistical sort of proto-statistical studies. And he's sort of engaging in a kind of ethnography, really, of what's happening to women in villages around West Bengal. small. But what I decided was some of these lists, because they'll drop them in the middle of an injection and they'll take several pages just to look through the names, they have a slightly disruptive effect on the flow of his argument. So I decided to take them out, put them in a section of the book at the back called Supporting Evidence. And then I just, in asterisk and an unambiguous referent number there in the text, so that you know, okay, right here, something's been moved to the back. You can go look at it if you want to. But if you're enjoying or just kind of appreciating the flow of the argument at that point, you don't necessarily need to see it. And it can be stuck back there. That can include long lists of caste names and villages and some of the data that helps unpack the specifics of Ulan history. But I don't think most English language readers are going to need to see that primarily. But those lists with the interest in their sort of philological curiosity, Sanskrit texts, this kind of thing, I put that in the back just to kind of make the argument and the rhetoric more to the fore and let the evidence sit back there. It's still all there. Nothing's been taken out. It's just been moved. And I hope is that the book is a little more accessible for that.
Without question. I mean, the details are there for those who need them or are interested in them. The data is there. And so all you're doing is, you know, creating footnotes or creating this appendix sort of situation. And so it makes sense to my mind that what you do is you render more clear the line of thought within the main body. But not at the expense. It's not that data ends up on the cutting room floor. It's there for those who need it. And so I think you have the best. No, I mean to say you have the best of both worlds in there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So you mentioned footnotes. It's interesting. Because he was a prolific writer and publisher on his own, he had his own printing press. He's quite good at the kind of paratextual apparatus himself. So there are footnotes in the text, and those are all his. And the text was complete with footnotes. He uses them quite skillfully. Ones that I felt were just Udvana Tattva 2.1 or something, I took those out, put that in the body with text so that we found it. But he also uses more expository footnotes, and I left all of those in because those will be what you see him thinking and seeing you hear. You see him deciding what's important but not sort of need to be the main argument that should be at the bottom of the page. So that's kind of nice. And then all the endnotes are mine. So the footnotes are his and the endnotes are mine. And I think, again, that helps kind of keep it clean and clear what's going on.
So what do you most hope folks would take away from this? What's your key argument other than the translation itself?
Yeah, thank you. I think one of the two things, if I can be allowed to have a twofold takeaway to a one takeaway.
As many as you want.
There is the translation, obviously. And I tried to let that be what it is and hope that people will find it and do with it some things that I might not even be able to imagine, the questions they might bring to it, the uses they might put it to. And I hope I haven't done any disservice to it such that it can serve that for English language readers and maybe encourage some to go off and discover the Bangla text. The other thing I would want to do is to provide through the introduction that I provided both the historical context to understand this changing moment in which the work is created. And then I've added quite a bit about my own interpretation of what's distinctive about the work, even compared to the other great work that he did on social reform or on widow marriage, are these elements of data collection and empirical study and sort of proto-sociological method that I made a case elsewhere that this is not a Bidbashagar people are accustomed to seeing. They tend to think of him as a Sanskrit pundit, therefore he's kind of hidebound, therefore he's not open to new methodologies or epistemologies. But in here, he really shows us that he's paying attention. He's part of the world in which the census is coming online as a way to gather data about peoples. He's attentive to the idea of kind of positivistic research. He also uses a mode of historical critical analysis that, again, we don't associate with pundits. We think of pundits as just going and finding proof texts and throwing them at one another. But he's actually asking, is this a valid text? to on what does its authority rest? Can we actually trust it, right? So he's going back and he's unpacking the narratives around pluralism that have been generated from within the communities, and he's asking, to what degree do these hold water, right? Which is, I think, something I'd love readers to take away, is to realize this is a Sanskrit pundit, but he's working with a really robust set of tools, many of them quite quote unquote modern, right? And very sophisticated. So it's more than just an exercise in scripture. Well, it's far more complex work, and that's what I'd hope we might discover.
Fascinating. It's fascinating. Is there anything else about the work that you would like to touch on for today?
That's a good question. I appreciated your question about translation. I think that's a really important issue. You and I think a lot about it. I know I always err on the side of trying to be pretty resolute about being consistent in how I translate my terms, whether they're Sanskrit or Bengali. I'm sure you're saying is that if I translate Adivedana, say, as supersession, then I'll always translate it as supersession. I try to, in that sense, so that a reader reading in English has some trust, because I provided glossaries in the back, both from the Sanskrit and Bala to English, and then from English, so that they can find their way in the text. And I like to be as consistent as I can be that way without playing fast and loose with the terminology. So I hope that might be appreciated. But last thing I'd say is just a big shout out to all the people who helped me with it in that lockdown period when we were communicating by Zoom and email and WhatsApp and all of that. You're never really alone, it turns out. You can still be connected and benefit from all this expertise and just supporting kindness out there. So that's maybe a nice thing to end with.
Beautiful. Well, thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me, Raj. You take care. Let's do it again.
Absolutely. For those listening, of course, we have been speaking with Brian Hatcher on a brand new OUP publication, Against High Caste Polygamy. This is part of the AAR Religion and Translation series. A lot to think about in the content of this work, and also about this fascinating figure and the way in which he was thinking about his own culture and times. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating such figures of the past and the extent to which they are modern, quote unquote, versus pre-modern. Take care.